You've gotten to the point where your garden landscape is established for the summer. As you seek alternative projects, consider trying to attract wildlife. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jeff Schmidt in for Charity Nebbe. Whether it's luring hummingbirds, butterflies, squirrels, or chipmunks, gardening for wildlife is a great way to attract a number of critters into your environment. My guest on this Horticulture Day, Rebecca Christoffel, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist, and Richard Geron, ISU Extension Horticulturist. They are here to answer all of your lawn and gardening questions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jeff Schmidt in for Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day on this last Friday in June, and we're going to start the hour talking about establishing a garden to attract wildlife. What are some of the do's and don'ts when it comes to starting or sustaining a wildlife garden? A little later on, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron will join the conversation to answer your yard and garden questions. But with me right now is Rebecca Christoffel, ISU Extension Wildlife Specialist. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, Jeff.
How are you today?
I'm great. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. I'm in Charity Nebbe's hot seat today, but I'm a little excited about this topic. Many people have gardens out there. What are some of the basics when they want to start looking at an ecosystem or wildlife garden?
Well, it's really pretty easy. A lot of things that gardeners do as it is when they're not even trying to attract wildlife do attract wildlife. And if you just think about it, what are the basic requirements for any animal? They need food. They need water. They need cover of some sort. And depending on the kind of wildlife that you are trying to attract, they need different levels in terms of space available to them.
So are there things that we're doing naturally with our gardens that are maybe hurting animals from joining the party, so to speak?
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up. I just did a program last night called Sharing Your Garden with Wildlife, and my audience had a very different idea of sharing their garden with wildlife than we're talking about today. It was really talking about wildlife damage management. And so, you know, we put plants out there. And plants are food for lots of different kinds of wildlife. Our most mega charismatic species being the white-tailed deer, which is known to feed on more than 300 different kinds of plants. And just about nothing you do will discourage them from coming and sharing in your bounty. But there are some practices that really aren't very wildlife friendly. And that includes what I try to get across to people is that neat grounds are no good for wildlife. Wildlife wants that leaf litter out there. They want that woody debris out there because it gives a little added moisture to their surroundings. And it also gives them cover, places to hide. And for some of the animals, things like reptiles and amphibians, it actually helps in terms of regulating their body temperature by giving them a somewhat cooler microclimate in which to be residing when we have heat index temperatures like we're going to have today. Pesticides, herbicides of all different kinds, you know, have varying effects on different kinds of wildlife or on the prey items, the insects that the wildlife will feed on.
Isn't it important to know what wildlife inhabits your garden or your backyard area to know, you know, how to welcome them into the area?
Yes, I talk about the cycle of wildlife management. And there are differing opinions on this, but my own philosophy is the first thing that you do is find out what you have already in terms of habitat types, in terms of plants or vegetation, in terms of specific little structures that are important for wildlife, and what you have living on your property now. Because learning that information can be really important in terms of defining what your objectives are going to be, what your goals are going to be for your wildlife management plan or your wildlife garden.
So when we're talking about plants and what we can plant to be more conducive for animals, what are some of the specifics here? What are do's and don'ts as far as planting specific plants, native plants?
Well, I was going to say the first big rule, the golden rule to me, is to use native plants versus non-native plants. For one, the wildlife that we have here has existed with our native plant species for a much longer time than anything that's non-native here. And so, again, they're going to utilize those native plants much more than non-native plants. Depending on what you're trying to attract, if you want to attract hummingbirds and butterflies, you know, we want those nice, showy red, orange, pink flowers. You want to have a good nectar source with hummingbirds. You know, you're going to have a long tubed flower, something akin to a trumpet creeper, but I don't necessarily advise planting that plant. But those sorts of flowers are really attractive to hummingbirds. With butterflies, there are all sorts of plants, and the best reference I could give people to find out specific plants to use in Iowa is either the Ladybird Johnson Center for Wildflowers. They have specific guides for each state. You can also go to the National Wildlife Federation website, and they have specifics on butterflies and the particular plants that will attract the greatest diversity of butterflies. Now, if you want a specialist, something like monarchs, you're going to have milkweeds. Or swallowtails, you may have something like spicebush. But there are lots and lots of other butterflies and moths out there.
Well, I have some friends that have a garden, and they're trying to attract birds. And my friend was telling me sometime it's even more important to have structure in your garden to attract certain birds. Is that true?
Oh, particularly when it comes to birds that are here now that are trying to raise families. Basically, when it comes to bird diversity, the greater number of layers that you have in terms of structure, the greater diversity of birds that you're going to have using an area. Some birds nest on the ground. Some birds nest just a foot off the ground in basket-like nests that they weave among the reeds or cattails. Other birds will nest way up in the canopy. Many of our warbler species nest way up in the canopy, but others may nest only 10 feet off the ground in something like alder or sumac.
Interesting. What about the soil? Is there anything different we can be doing with the soil when we tend to our gardens that would help attract certain wildlife?
Well, the only thing that I can think of is having soil that is friable, that is easy to work. Of course, any kind of animal that digs is going to enjoy that. For certain beneficial insects, they too want to be using soil as a place to reside. And so if they can get down into the soil, that's going to work a lot better for them than very clayey type soil. So basically, turning the soil over and making it friable will be very attractive to wildlife species.
And I guess this may depend on what you're trying to attract, but is there any water management with the garden that would help in this department?
Oh, sure. There are lots of things you can do in a garden. There are people who specifically they make a rain garden. And the rain garden, a lot of times it's sold to people as a way to filter the water and that and to reduce runoff. But actually, it also produces habitat for lots of different kinds of wildlife. In the past, wildlife was just defined really as birds and mammals. But now we think of it in a much broader sense. So things like dragonflies and damselflies, and I should mention that in the UK or in England, they actually have dragonfly clubs. We have birding clubs in the US. Over in England, they have dragonfly clubs, which I thought was really pretty cool. But dragonflies are becoming more popular here. There are some excellent websites out there where you can identify dragonflies that you find here in Iowa. Those rain gardens are also good for other kinds of wildlife, things like frogs or toads. If it's holding water long enough, they'll actually use it as a place for mating. So water management is definitely something that you want to do for wildlife. They appreciate having access to water. The one thing I should mention is having a farm pond with fish in it is a little different than providing water sources for wildlife. A lot of wildlife, including dragonflies and damselflies, frogs and toads, really do much better in waters without fish. And so if you have something that's shallow enough and it's not going to support fish populations, that's an added bonus for a lot of other kinds of animals.
You touched on this a little bit earlier, but I wanted to get into it a little more with herbicides and pesticides. How detrimental are they to wildlife? And there's a fine line between managing your garden with that and trying to attract animals.
Yes, there is. And what I can say is, you know, there have been all sorts of studies on one specific pesticide and what it does to one specific species. So I would be incorrect or I would be mistaken or really untruthful if I could say what each pesticide was going to do. What I can say is this. There has been some evidence in terms of insect-eating beneficial wildlife, things like bats, things like small snakes, things like frogs, that will not exist in areas where you have a lot of chemicals being applied to the vegetation. And the reason is, or to insect populations, that these animals are eating these animals that have been poisoned. And in the case of bats, they bioaccumulate, they build up that poison in their fat. And when the bat is then hibernating over winter and it's drawing on all of its fat reserves, that breaks down the fat and those poisons are then circulating through the bat's body and can kill the bat.
We're coming up to a break, but if somebody's thinking about this, making their garden a wildlife garden, what's the first step? Is it small changes that are important one step at a time?
I definitely think it's baby steps, small changes, and then just keep building on them.
This is Horticulture Day on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jeff Schmidt in for Charity Nebbe. That is Rebecca Christoffel. She is a wildlife specialist at ISU Extension. We're talking about the benefits of gardening for wildlife. You can call us with your questions about wildlife gardening or your regular lawn and garden questions. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Richard Giron, ISU Extension horticulturist, joins the conversation next. Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Horticulture Day today. I'm Jeff Schmidt in for Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa. With me is Rebecca Christoffel, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist. And joining me now is Richard Giron, ISU Extension Horticulturist. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
And the phone lines are wide open for you to join the conversation. The number to call is 866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100. Welcome to join our conversation with questions about plants, your garden, maybe a question about establishing a wildlife garden. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Let's go right to the phone lines. Paul is on the line from Des Moines. Good morning, Paul.
Morning. Good morning to everyone. Yeah, I had a question about how effective I think it's corn sorghum is as a like a lawn pre-emergent herbicide pre-emergent, and if it is corn sorghum, where you can get it from?
Actually, it's corn gluten meal.
Oh yeah, okay, yes.
And it's a byproduct, milling byproduct, and you can find that at garden centers.
Okay.
It's basically put on in the spring of the year, and it basically helps to control things like crabgrass.
Right.
So in central Iowa, probably sometime around mid to late April.
Okay.
As far as an application date.
Okay, and it is pretty effective then?
It does a very good job in that situation. What it basically does, it interferes with the germination of the crabgrass seed. And so it does a fairly good job.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call, Paul in Des Moines, called 866-780-9100. Julie was on the line earlier, but left before she could get her question in. You know, we were talking about how to attract wildlife. Julie wants to know, she says she's got two raccoons in her backyard under her deck near the garden, how to get rid of them. This goes cattywampus to what we were talking about earlier, but how does she get rid of those raccoons?
Yeah, that actually goes right in with what my topic was last night, and that's dealing with wildlife that you're not necessarily wanting. At this time of year, having two raccoons or multiple raccoons in an area generally means you've got an adult and some subadults or some juveniles. And it's very difficult at that point to discourage these animals from leaving. What you can do is if you can exclude the animals from getting under the porch, that would be the most effective way to discourage them. You can try hazing them, going out, and when you see them around, trying to make a lot of noise and scare them off. When worse comes to worse and you actually have to remove the animals, you know, I really don't like the idea of live trapping and moving animals. I'm told it's legal in the state of Iowa, but it's not something that I think really benefits the animals or wherever it is that you leave them out. You're probably leaving them out where there's a resident population. You want to make your area, your homestead, as unattractive to that raccoon as possible. Now, having said that, raccoons are commensals. They do better in our presence because of our garbage and places like porches that they can nest under. But trying to exclude them, you can also try an area repellent. There are ones that have dried egg solids in them as the active ingredient. And trying to scare it off with loud noises, or if you have a large dog, that can sometimes work wonders.
The thoughts of Rebecca Christoffel, ISU Extension Wildlife Specialist. We head back to the phone lines, and Marcia is on the line from Iowa City. Marcia.
Good morning. I'm so glad to be here today. Say, something is eating my morning glories and kind of spreading around in my flower bed. This is tiny, half-circle, smaller than a ladybug, metallic gold critter. And I don't know what it is. I haven't been able to identify it. I think it might be nocturnal. Do you have any ideas for me on this?
I have no idea. That'd be a good question for Donald Lewis, our entomologist here at Iowa State. And his phone number is 515-294-1111.
Thank you so much. I have spoken with him before, and he's a great resource.
He is.
Thank you, Marcia, for the phone call. Let's go to Jim in Urbandale. Jim may have a question that relates back to our first segment. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I just moved to Iowa from Minnesota this week, so curious about what potential wildlife I can attract to my backyard. I have noticed fireflies so far in the evenings, and are there any tips on how to get that particular insect in greater numbers in my backyard? And then the only bird I've seen so far is a mourning dove, and I'm wondering what types of birds I can expect to be seen in my backyard and how to attract more of them.
Great question. Welcome to Iowa, by the way.
Well, thank you. Yeah, short-time listener, first-time caller. Well,
that's quite all right. Hey, I'm sort of a short-timer myself. I've only lived here 3 years. But I can make a couple of recommendations to you, and I can give you a little further information about what you might actually attract to your yard. For one, it's going to depend on what you've got in your yard. If you have a hedge, if you have trees, either alive or dead, One thing that many people do not understand is the importance of what we call snags or dead trees to wildlife. Things like woodpeckers are highly dependent on those structures for their nesting and raising of youngsters. So depending on what you have available, there are different species that will come. But certainly you'll have things like mourning doves, black-capped chickadees, house finches, American goldfinch. In terms of mammals, you'll certainly have things like fox squirrels and cottontail rabbits and probably white-tailed deer. There certainly was a lot of evidence. I was just down in Urbandale last night looking at a garden, and there was plenty of evidence there. Bats, though we don't usually get to see them because they're active at night, will be around. But if you go to the Iowa State University Extension and Outreach Wildlife site, you can download a publication freely that talks about how to attract birds, and it includes the different kinds of birds that you might expect to find on your property. And that's just www.extension.iastate.edu/wildlife, all one word, all lowercase, / and then the word publications. And you'll find lots of information there in terms of what's native to Iowa and how you can go about attracting it.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Jim dialed 866-780-9100. Have an email here from Pierce. Pierce writes, rabbits have decimated the greens on my carrots this year. I believe that the greens will regrow, but that the carrot root won't grow as energy is directed into forming new greens. Will the carrots eventually start to grow larger once the greens regrow, or should I dig them up even though they are still quite small?
Go ahead and leave those. If the foliage comes back, then they'll form a root. Obviously, it may be much smaller than normal, but it should form an edible root.
Let's go back to the telephone, and Earl is on the line in Des Moines. Earl, welcome to Talk of Iowa.
Thank you. I got a question that has to do with irises. We had good irises until we inadvertently bought some from a source that allowed us to import iris borers. What can I do to get back to a healthy population of iris now?
Well,
and
what I would
do. What's the best way to prevent importing more borers if we order from another out-of-state company?
Well, they're actually very common in Iowa. So that's typically they're out and about in the environment. But as far as controlling them, what I would do would be if you suspect you have a problem, I would go out in July and I would dig them all up. And I would examine each rhizome and only replant those that have solid, firm rhizomes. Those that are soft or mushy, I would destroy. Then late in the fall, like in November, I would cut back the iris foliage. The female insect, the adult, will lay her eggs on the foliage of the bearded iris. And so if you remove that in late fall, you're removing most of the eggs. Okay. One last thing you can do is in the spring, when that new foliage is about 4 to 6 inches in length, spray that with an insecticide. That typically coincides with egg hatch of the iris borer. So if you do those things, that should help quite a bit.
Okay, thank you.
Once again, Earl dialed 866-780-9100. Let's go to Tom, who is on the line in Moline. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. I have two hibiscus plants almost in the same area. One is doing really well. The other one, I'm sure it has aphids and like sticky stuff with the aphids. And now a bunch of the leaves are turning yellow and like dying, and I wondered what I should do.
Well, in fact, if they are aphids, I would spray them with insecticidal soap, which you can find at any garden center.
Okay.
Are there any things that fly, and are they small and white? Because hibiscus are basically white fly magnets They just draw the white flies, and they're very, very common. And they typically feed on the underside of the foliage. And when you approach the plant, when you touch the plant, disturb the plant, they kind of flutter around in a cloud around the plant. And they're very common on hibiscus. And so if that's what you have, make sure that you spray the underside of the foliage with that insecticidal soap, because that's where they are. Okay. And you probably have to do this maybe on a weekly basis for several weeks.
Okay. And they need a lot of water, correct?
Yes, they do. They like a moist soil, so I would say water them once a week or so when it's dry.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Once again, that number to call is 866-780-9100. We have some lines open now if you'd like to join us in the conversation. It's Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. Rudy is on the line with a question. Rudy, welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is that I have got these weeds that come up around my bushes and around my flower beds, and I'm wondering, I have mulch down there, like they're coming through the mulch, and if I spray with Roundup, is that going to kill my bushes?
No, it wouldn't. In that regard, Roundup is only absorbed by living tissue. The root system will not absorb it, so you can use it around trees and shrubs as long as you don't get it on the trees and shrubs. So you have to be careful, but if you're careful, okay, You'll be okay.
Okay. And my next question is, I have two peach trees in my yard, and I didn't get enough time this springtime to trim, and now on one of my peach trees, I have some dead branches with nothing on it. Could I trim those now?
Right. If you have a tree, whether it's a fruit tree or a shade tree or even a shrub, if you see a dead limb in that plant during the summer, you can prune it out because it's dead. It's not providing anything for the plant itself, so you can do that any time of the year.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Rudy, for calling. Here's an email. Megan is asking, have a mostly wooded one-acre lot in the middle of town. I have a fox den in my yard for the first time, and I've noticed a lower consumption of hosta by deer this year. Do the two things have anything to do with each other, or have the deer just found tastier meals elsewhere? If the fox family is making the yard a less attractive place to dining establishment for deer, how do I keep the fox family from coming back?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think that the foxes really are having much to do with the level of eating that the deer are doing. I think it's far more likely that they have found something even more delectable nearby to feed on. Foxes are really, really small little predators, and all they're going to do is be eating things like mice or very small snakes and that sort of prey item. They really pose no threat to deer whatsoever, and I would think that the deer would interpret the fox just like deer interpret dogs. You know, most deer do not have a whole lot of fear of dogs.
Let's go back to the phone lines on this Horticulture Day. Dennis is joining us from Vinton. Hey, Dennis.
Hello. Yes, I had a cluster of five Osage orange trees that went down last July. And in the process of cutting them up, one of the limbs went down about 10 inches diameter.
Oh, we lost Dennis there on the line. Dennis, give us a call back there if we have some lines open. Dennis, give us a call back at 866-780-9100. Let's go to Ann. Ann is in West Branch.
Hi. I live right in town, and we have a feeder where we feed cardinals and other birds out in the yard. And one day I noticed a female cardinal feeding a young that was certainly didn't look like a baby cardinal, and I figured out it was a baby cowbird. And since then, I've been seeing cowbirds pretty frequently at our feeder, and I'm wondering, is that going to decrease the ability of the cardinals to reproduce, and should I be discouraging these cowbirds from coming around somehow?
Well, cowbirds are natural native birds to the area. And actually, they used to follow the bison herds around. And so it's perfectly natural that they are parasitizing. That's what we call it. It's brood parasitism. That is the female cowbird. She gets to save all the energy of incubating eggs and raising youngsters, she just goes and finds somebody else's nest and drops her egg in there. A lot of times the cowbirds themselves will hatch out before the other birds in the nest and will be considerably larger than the other youngsters in the nest. And because they're larger, they squawk more loudly and they're able to sort of bully their nest mates and get a lot of attention from the adults. In terms of, you know, encouraging them, I don't think you're encouraging them any more than you're encouraging the other birds. So I wouldn't necessarily be overly concerned. Our cardinal populations do not appear to be suffering from cowbird parasitism in a big way. However, there are a number of other birds, particular woodland nesting birds, that are naive to cowbirds and don't respond appropriately to that egg that looks different from the rest of their eggs. And that is a problem for many of those birds. So one of the things is to cut down on the number of edge habitats that you have.
Anne, thank you very much for the phone call. This is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Jeff Schmidt in for Charity Nebbe, Rebecca Christoffel, and Richard Giron answering all of your questions, and more questions coming up right after the break. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio, Horticulture Day today on this Friday. Jeff Schmidt in for Charity Nebbe. Rebecca Christoffel, Iowa State University Extension Wildlife Specialist, is with us, as well as Richard Giron, ISU Extension Horticulturist. Answering all of your questions at 866-780-9100. A couple lines are open, and I want to get back to Dennis, who I cut off earlier. Dennis, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I had a cluster of five Osage oranges last year that went down in the storm. In the process of cutting these up, we had a 10-inch limb that fell into the ground, and now after it's long gone, it's over, going almost on a year. Nothing is growing in that spot. Is that sap from the Osage orange toxic to anything that wants to grow?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
So nothing will grow in that area at all?
No. No weeds, nothing.
Okay. There are a number of plants that are allelopathic, like the black walnut, for example, which is a good example. But as far as the Osage orange, I don't believe so.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Dennis in Vinton. Let's go down to Fairfield and check in with Laverne.
Hi. I have two red oak trees in my backyard. I think they're about 8 years old, 9 years old. And the branches have leaves on the outside, but all the inner branches, there's no leaves. I don't know what's going on with the tree. Should I cut those inner branches off, or will they release, or is it not enough water because it's been awful here?
I would just leave them. As long as they have foliage, they're supplying food for the plant. So they don't have to have foliage all along the branch.
Are really full of dead branches, smaller dead branches, and, you know, littler branches that came off the big branch. Okay. If the ends have leaves, but the inners, is something wrong?
I don't think there's anything drastically wrong, no. If you have small little limbs on the inside canopy, that's not a major problem. You can prune those off if you wish.
Oh, because it's very odd. I never had a red oaks before, and it's like they're empty inside.
Yeah.
And I didn't know if that was common to red oaks or if it was a drought or what.
If you look at any big tree, oftentimes toward the inside of the canopy, there's dead little limbs. That's pretty common.
Inside, just at the end. Okay.
So it's a young tree, and you might consider watering that tree this summer if it stays hot and dry. And I would do it every 10 or 14 days or so, and that should encourage growth. How much growth are you getting at the ends?
The ends seem fine.
Okay. Are you getting like 6 inches or a foot? I mean, if you're getting like 6 inches or a foot of growth at the end of the branch, that's a pretty healthy tree.
Okay, don't worry about it.
Nope.
It's very odd looking, but I won't worry about it. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you from Fairfield. Let's go to Chris, who is in West Des Moines. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, I've got a quick question. I've got a purple plum tree, and I've got what I believe is a big infestation of June bugs, and they're eating the leaves pretty good, and I'm just wondering what I can do to repel them.
I would assume maybe Japanese beetles
would be
my guess. If it is, they have a metallic green head.
Okay.
And the lower part of the body is kind of a copper color.
Okay, that's what
and,
it is.
And they love certain plants, like, for example, lindens, prunus, or plums.
Mm-hmm.
So they like certain plants, and they can actually devour the foliage.
Yes.
The good news is, even though they may defoliate a tree, they don't kill it.
Okay.
Okay, they don't. So as far as control, that's very similar to trying to paddle upstream in a canoe. You're probably not going to accomplish much.
Okay.
You could spray with an insecticide if you chose.
Okay.
But you'd have to do that once a week, maybe twice a week, for maybe 4 to 5 weeks.
Oh, all right.
Because they won't be gone until probably mid-August at the earliest. So it can be very, very frustrating to do. I think with trees, if they're healthy trees, they can tolerate this damage.
Okay.
And I would be inclined to basically ignore them as best I could. They are very annoying, but I would kind of tend to ignore them as best I could.
Can I ask one other quick question?
Okay.
Sure.
I had a squash plant. It was doing extremely well, and some type of borer got into the vine. I'm going to replant. What can I do to prevent that in the future?
Well, if it is a squash vine borer, there's basically just one generation per year, and they should not be bothered at this point if you plant.
Oh, okay.
So if it's a squash vine borer, and if the plant dies, what I would do is pull that plant and then take a knife and kind of cut the stem lengthwise and see if you can find a fairly large, pudgy, worm-like insect inside, and that would confirm it.
Yes, I did.
Okay. But the good thing is you can still plant summer squash, and if you plant at this date, they should not be affected.
Oh, great. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Melissa has an email kind of along the lines of Chris's first question. I'm dealing with fairly heavy Japanese beetle infestation for the third year in a row. I've been considering using milky spore for long-term control. I'm in a fairly dense neighborhood. If I'm the only one treating my yard, how much benefit should I expect to see? And do I need to apply the milky spore annually?
The answer is no benefit, unfortunately, because your yard is just a small speck in the landscape. They basically prefer to lay their eggs in grassy areas, like lawns, but also roadside ditches, playgrounds, pastures, any grassy area. So if you treat your yard with anything, whether it's milky spore, a traditional insecticide, it's really not going to impact the Japanese beetle population next year. So it really doesn't help, unfortunately.
So Melissa, take that and see how you can deal with your backyard. Let's head up to Blackhawk County and Waterloo, and David is on the line.
Yes, I have 3 acres wooded, and there's other residents that have 3 acres, and I've got some large brush piles that I haven't been able to move for about 10 years, and I've got lots of marmots, and I'm sympathetic to them, so I don't want to kill them, but I'd like to thin them out or relocate them or something. What can I do?
Are the brush piles going to get moved?
Yes, I want to use forks on a loader bucket and lift the piles up so that they can get out of there. You know, I know they're down in the earth, but
yeah. Once you get rid of those brush piles, I think that you're going to find the animals moving off. There's no longer that cover available to them. You said marmots?
Yeah, groundhog,
woodchucks. Oh, woodchucks. Yeah, woodchucks. Well, this year is an exceptional year, I think, not only for woodchucks, but lots of other animals. We had a very mild winter, and I think those populations are doing very well. What I can tell you is making the habitat unavailable to them, the shelter unavailable to them, will help in discouraging them. But other than that, you really don't want to be live trapping and moving them around. Instead, it's better to basically withhold resources from them. And when the time comes, I mean, if it got to be too bad, if you were having damage, then you would really need to be concerned. But it doesn't sound as if they're actually doing any damage.
Yeah, I keep them away from buildings and stuff. So I'll do that because I think the Cedar River is only about 3/4 mile away, and I think they'll find their way in that direction.
Yep, I don't think they'll have any problem finding a new place to live. We've got lots of great habitat for groundhogs.
Yeah. Could I make a comment about bird attraction?
Sure.
We found that putting out the orange slices and the grape jelly early and keeping them out, and we finally got a lot of orioles hanging around, males and females. So
yep,
that's another thing you can do. Keep those orange slices and that grape jelly out.
Good point.
Early in the spring and keep it out there.
We hear them chirping in the backyard there, David. I can hear them through the phone. Thanks for the call.
All right, thanks.
David dialed 866-780-9100. We head to Central Iowa and Des Moines. Joanne is on the line.
Hi. We are having a little problem with a section of our garden, and I wondered if you could help us with that.
You've come to the right place, Joanne. What do you have?
What kind of problem?
We have a section where the potatoes, the squash, the cucumbers all have curly edges, and they're kind of deformed looking. And we were wondering whether or not it could be caused by the way we put the composted material from last year onto the garden.
Boy, I would think not. What did you put in there? What was the compost made from?
Just, garden weeds and plants from last year.
I would think not. Okay. Did someone apply a broadleaf herbicide possibly within the last few weeks?
I would say no, we haven't really done that, but we did do some work around the raspberry patch, which is not too far away, earlier in the spring.
Okay. Well, as far as if you apply a broadleaf herbicide like 2,4-D, dicamba, those are growth regulator herbicides, and people commonly apply those to lawns to control broadleaf weeds, but if they drift, they will cause leaves to curl and twist and distort.
Okay.
Tomatoes, for example, are very, very sensitive to it. So that could explain possibly why plants on one side of the garden are doing that if someone did apply something recently.
Joanne, thank you for that call from Des Moines. Let's, coming up to the top of the hour, want to get as many calls in as possible. Let's go to Lori in Cedar Rapids.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions, and I'll try to see if I can get them both in quickly. We have a ton of chipmunks in our backyard, and we have a dog that runs around and chases them and tries to get some, but she doesn't get very many. And I would like to reduce that population because it's just, there's just holes everywhere, and they're kind of annoying. My sister has bull snakes in her sort of wild wooded backyard, and I was teasing her the other day about how she needed to bring her bull snakes over here. I was wondering, seriously, if she could grab some of the smaller ones and bring them over to my yard, what kind of an impact that might have. Is that a good idea? Is that a bad idea? Are the snakes, going to bother the dog, or is the dog going to chase the snakes? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, good question. And you bring up a really good bigger issue, and that's translocating or moving wildlife from one area to another. And I generally highly discourage that. And the reason reason for that is this with the snakes, okay? The snakes generally are what we call phylopatric. They're faithful to a den site. Den sites are places where they overwinter or hibernate. Are in short supply generally on the landscape or limited supply. And if they have a hibernaculum by your sister's place, they know where to go to spend the winter. if you take particularly young ones and bring them over to your place, they aren't going to have that sort of cue as to where it's safe to overwinter.
Okay, that's very interesting. I hadn't thought of that. If there's time, I have another really quick question.
Sure.
Okay, I have ivy growing up in evergreen. It's English ivy that I put there on purpose to be ornamental. It's a great big old evergreen. It looks to have a bluish tint. It's very sharp needled. And it looks like it's deteriorating. I think it started before I put the ivy in, but I'm not sure. Is that ivy impacting the growth of the tree, or is it possibly that fungus or virus or whatever it is that you keep talking about many trees being infected with?
It could be affecting the tree if the ivy is growing out to the canopy and beginning to cover the canopy. In that situation, that is going to cause damage. And so if that were occurring, if it's actually growing out on the canopy of the evergreen tree, I would remove it.
You mean out on the branches, or do you mean out of underneath on
right.
the ground?
Under the ground is perfectly fine, but if it's actually growing along the outside of the branches where it's covering the... Okay, if it's not doing that, then it's not a problem.
Okay, so it doesn't grow into the bark or anything like that.
No,
okay.
No, it basically climbs it. It may climb it, but
right.
it's actually not taking anything away from the bark.
Okay, thank you for that. Thank you so much for allowing me to call in. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Lori. Lori called 866-780-9100. Let's go to Gerald, who has a question from Waverly.
Yes, I don't know if anyone has this problem, but... I have a squirrel that goes up in the tree, and he in maple trees particularly, and he goes and eats the bark off, or where I've sawed off a limb, and he will eat that. And if he goes all the way around that limb dies. What can be done about that?
Well, there are some, you know, depending on how high this is, there are some repellents that you can put on plants to keep animals from eating them. The most effective, cheapest one that I know of is something like Tabasco sauce or something that has what they call capsaicin in it. If you aren't able to get up there to apply something like that, I don't know of another way other than getting rid of the squirrel.
Gerald, I hope that answers your question. One more call here to wrap up the hour. Bev is with us. Bev, you're on the air.
Yes, my question is about a tomato that isn't my garden, but my friend, who says the tomato leaves are turning black along the edges. I wondered if that was overwatering.
I wouldn't think so. If it were overwatering, they'd turn yellow.
Okay.
Now, as far as watering, if they're in the ground, once a week should be fine.
Mm-hmm.
If they're in a container more often, obviously, but...
they're in the ground.
Okay. Possibly if they were fertilized too heavily, that could burn the foliage, and the edges might be brown, a dark brown.
Okay. He said he did use some Miracle-Gro on them.
Well, that's pretty dilute usually, so I wouldn't think that would be the major problem. But don't know offhand, but I don't think it's overwatering.
Okay.
If you do water, water once a week. If you do fertilize, fertilize moderately, not excessively.
Thank you for the call, Bev. We are out of time on this Horticulture Day. Rebecca Christoffel, Iowa State University Wildlife Specialist, and Richard Giron, ISU Extension Horticulturist, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Technical support today from Allison Sullivan and Alyssa Weiss. We always welcome your comments and questions. iowapublicradio.org. Charity Nebbe is back on Monday.